Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. And today we're going to talk with you about trees. They're always a stunning part of any landscape, especially when the leaves change color. I think it's kind of everything seems to be transformed this time of the year. And because they are so stable and reliable, it can be easy to overlook them sometimes when we think about caring for them. And that's one thing we can talk about today with our guest, Fred Clark, founder of Baraboo Woodworks. He's a career forester. He's an arborist, Wisconsin conservation leader. And Fred, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. Great to be here again.
And yeah, great to have you with us. And certainly as our listeners listen in, you can join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post your questions or your comments there. You know, this time of the year, trees really make their presence known when we have leaves changing color. What's the biology behind that process, basically?
Yeah, so what we're seeing this time of year are some of the pigments that are already in leaves, they're in those leaves all year round, that are being made visible by the reduction and elimination of chlorophyll in the leaves.
Yeah.
So, you know, the chlorophyll is the plant energy center. That's what produces the sugars that become the food source for the tree, and that gives the leaves its green color. This time of year, what happens is trees get a signal late in the year to start shutting down for the year. So it's either the length of the day, which for some species, a shorter day length in the fall actually triggers them to stop producing chlorophyll. For other species, it's colder temperatures and that first frost that triggers it. As that chlorophyll is basically converted into sugars that are stored in the roots, the red and yellow pigments, the carotenoids that produce yellow and the anthocyanin that produce red, those become visible, and that's what gives us that spectacular fall color, especially with species of the maples this time of year.
Yeah, and already we're getting some pretty good color. I think it's 30% color in about the central part of the state. Always enjoy driving through northern Wisconsin. I usually go on a muskie fishing trip in the north along about the end of September.
Yeah.
And just driving through the Ashland area, for example, with the hills there and the color, it's just unbelievably good.
Oh, it is. And, you know, it's as you know, it's become a big draw for tourism destinations in the fall. So when you can't sail and you can't snowmobile, that mid-season in places like Bayfield and Door County have been really important times for tourism.
And we take some calls. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You're the founder of Baraboo Woodworks. And tell us about that. Give us some information there.
Sure. Well, you know, in a career in forestry and tree care, one of the things that interests anybody in that business is how do we utilize trees when they're at the end of their life? And I think for many years, everyone in this industry or this sector has recognized that there's just a lot of waste or a lot of lost opportunity. So when trees have to be removed, either because they've died or they're cut down, you know, traditionally they've been sent through a chipper or sent to a landfill. And that's been the destination for the, you know, greater than 90% of most of the wood that comes out of our urban communities. So Baraboo Woodworks is one of many businesses in this area that are trying to make the connections to actually create outlets by milling and drying and finding desirable long-term end uses for urban wood.
Yeah, and it's really, I was thinking about that today as I was, actually this morning I was down in the basement, and there was a very large tree in our backyard when we moved into this house about 3 years ago, and it had to come down. It was a danger.
Yeah.
It had to come down, but I had the guys save a couple of slices or slabs for a potential for tables or something to do with them, and I'm just letting them go. They're drying in the basement. And they have been for 3 years, so I haven't lifted one up lately. But hopefully they're drying to the point where we can do something with them.
Well, and I think if you look at basements and attics, you know, all around Wisconsin, you'll find a whole lot of wood like yours, right? Because it's many people make an extra effort to try to utilize some part of the wood from a tree that maybe they lived with in their backyard for 30 years. And there's a connection there that makes it worth doing something extra to keep some of that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so you make things then out of with your business then?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're providing the next step in the chain. We bring in wood from local tree services who are taking down trees, and we mill that wood and we dry it, and we're making it available to furniture makers, hobbyists, artisans. And as we continue to develop that business model, we'll also be working with designers and home remodelers just to find the best uses for this wood so it can really make its way into the kind of built environment where we value local products.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got lots of callers online. Dan in Madison has a question for you. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. I have a question about the little update on the emerald ash borer. I was wondering, I have a couple of ash trees I don't want to, you know, see let go. And I was over at one of the garden centers, and they said I could apply this this product, but to do so, you know, maybe in the fall or early spring or something when the cycle of the ash borer would catch the cycle, you know, when they're starting to come alive or something after the winter, but to apply it in the fall or early spring. And I was just wondering what the pros and cons of doing it yourself were, rather than getting an arborist who's trained and knows what
They're doing.
Yeah, you bet. Well, it's a good time to ask that question. So as most of your listeners know, we've had emerald ash borer in Wisconsin now for a number of years and just had a verified identification here in Madison in Dane County last year. So anyone that has ash trees in their landscape around their home or property needs to be thinking about whether you want to protect that tree and try to prevent it from being damaged or killed likely by the emerald ash borer. My recommendation on injections is to engage a certified arborist to evaluate that tree and to do a professional quality injection. If that tree is valuable enough to you on your property to make it worth an investment in saving it, it is worth hiring a professional who can evaluate the safety of the tree, whether there's other condition factors that might warrant making a decision about whether this is the right tree to invest that kind of resources in. I think the extra money you spend to hire a professional is really insurance that you're making the right investment in the right place and it'll be done properly. And when it is done properly, the success rate of using chemicals like triage as a systemic injection.
Very high. Isn't
very
it?
High.
Yeah.
And less environmental impact, I would add, than the soil drench type of application that homeowners would generally have to do themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's worth it, too, just as you point out, if you've got a large ash tree or just a beautiful ash tree, you know, you still want to know if that tree is healthy before you go and spend the money. And that's where your arborist comes in.
That's right. It could be a several hundred dollar investment potentially, but you need to make sure that tree is worth it. A large, healthy shade tree certainly can provide those kind of benefits where that investment is worth it, but that's what you need to know before you spend the money.
Yeah.
Should I go to the UW Extension webpage, or how do you get a list of arborists?
Yeah, you probably want a certified arborist, wouldn't you say, Fred?
Yes, you do, and you could go to your county extension webpage. You could also go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association, WAA. If you Google Wisconsin Arborist Association, they will have a listing of certified arborists in the area, and there are many well-qualified consulting arborists in, you're in the Madison area.
Yeah, quite a lot.
There are many in Dane County. You'll have no shortage of the ability to engage a qualified professional to help you out with
that. And a certified arborist is somebody who's had additional education and kind of really knows what they're doing.
That's right. And we do not have a state licensure for arborists in Wisconsin, but the Certified Arborist Program is managed by the International Society of Arboriculture, and that's proof of their professional competence and experience.
Yeah, there you go, Dan.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks for calling. Sam in La Crosse, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, last year I planted a black gum tree kind of towards the end of summer, and then we had that nasty winter.
Yep.
And this year I thought when spring came around that it was for sure dead, but the last half foot of it did start to grow, but the top two-thirds or more is dead. And I was just wondering, like, is it worth trying to salvage? Will it end up growing right since that top lead is dead, or is it a lost cause?
So, Sam, what's the diameter of the trunk of that tree near the ground?
Diameter?
I mean, is it an inch or two?
It's a half inch to an inch. It's a skinny guy.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like your thumb and finger, you can get around it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. At this point, don't give up on that tree. If you are seeing live buds that are starting to grow below where the dieback was, that can be the beginning of a new sapling that you can work with. What it sounds like, you may have had some frost damage or maybe other damage that killed that top. But really, the question for that tree is how viable is the root system? And if you've got green buds that are developing below that dead zone.
Yeah, it grew out new branches, like about a half a foot off the ground. There's nice little branches with leaves and whatnot. But should I do with that dead top part? Should I cut it back then?
Yeah, at this point, what you could do is to cut back the dead part where you know it's dead. For now, you could leave a little stub on there if you're uncertain about it. Let that new shoot develop. Let it come through next year. And if it's vigorous and is starting to show decent growth, then you can start to train that and make a good pruning cut when you know exactly where the live tissue is and where the dead tissue is. So don't throw in the towel yet.
Okay. I'll hang in there.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mary in Whitewater, turn to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two questions, one about a lemon lights azalea and the other about a walnut tree. I'll start with the walnut tree. My new neighbors planted a very young walnut tree about two to 3 feet high, about 30 feet from my vegetable garden, and it's about 40 feet from their vegetables and about 50 feet from the next neighbor's vegetables. And I mentioned juglone to them and said it was going to poison the soil and pretty soon I wouldn't be able to grow anything. But I was wondering how long it will really take for that juglone to become toxic to the soil and to travel through the soil to my vegetable garden. And then the azalea, lemon lights azalea, bloomed beautifully in the spring. It's about 4 feet tall, got new buds on it, and it is reblooming now. And I'm really worried about it because it's going to exhaust itself.
Okay. A couple of good questions there, Mary. With regard to the walnut, this is not going to be your problem or your neighbor's problem, but it's going to be your children's problem and your neighbor's children's problem. You know, the size of that walnut tree right now and the distance from those gardens, that tree is not producing enough juglone to make any impact on the gardens, given how far away they are and its small size. But let that tree get to full size at maturity when its roots zone might be 50 feet and it might be dropping leaves.
Yeah.
You know, trees grow at kind of an exponential rate. They put on additional biomass more and more every year. So the volume of leaf material and root material with juglone in it will increase over time. So I think you need to be looking down the road as to whether you both want to be affected by that 30 years from now.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the azalea?
That's a hard... Do you feel comfortable answering that one, Fred?
You know, my horticulture degree was Michigan State University, 1985. It's a little dusty, but I don't think you're going to stop that plant from blooming right now, so I don't know that you'd do anything but wait and see and maybe put a good mulching on those plants for the wintertime.
Yeah, I think it's about all you can do. Make sure it's watered well going into the winter. There you go, Mary. And tell you what, John and Green Bay coming up next, but I want to remind you that our guest today is Fred Clark, founder of Baraboo Woodworks, a career forester visiting with him about fall tree care. And also we're going to zero in a bit, too, on local wood utilization. We want to emphasize that as well as we go through the show today. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Michelle Good, our on-air producer today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on Garden Talk, next Friday, Lisa Johnson is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. She'll have some great advice for late-season gardening and garden cleanup. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Fred Clark about trees and their uses and their utilization. Fred, founder of Baraboo Woodworks. We have a link to his site, I believe, on my Facebook page as well. So you can go there if you want to learn some more. And we'll talk some more about the business and also about what some communities are doing in the way of utilizing the trees. And, you know, this kind of time in our lifespan when we've got emerald ash borer coming in, Fred, I mean, there's a lot of trees coming, a lot of ash trees coming down pretty quick.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what has, you know, community leaders and people in the wood products industry and you know, elected officials and mayors throughout the Midwest sort of engage in a conversation about what do we do with the huge volume of wood that's going to be generated here in the next 5 to 10 years as a result of emerald ash borer.
And you don't want it in the landfill. I mean, gee whiz.
No, you don't, for so many reasons. It's wasteful material in the landfill. It's expensive to landfill, and it becomes, you know, part of the emitting carbon into the atmosphere that we could avoid. And, you know, there's some interesting statistics on this question. There's been some various estimates, but nationwide, people have estimated that every year we generate somewhere from 14 to 19 million metric tons of tree waste.
Wow.
These are trees that are cut down throughout the country. And interestingly, that's more wood than is harvested on all of our national forest system throughout the country every year. So there's a huge amount of material there that could be utilized for wood products, but it also has an energy potential. And I think that's
right.
Where some of the real research is being directed now is how do we use that to fuel boilers and to create energy that can offset fossil fuel use and you know, bring payback to the community?
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot going on in that area. John in Green Bay has a question for you, so let's turn there. John, hi, thanks
hi,
for
good
waiting.
Morning. Say, you bet. My question's about a couple dead trees I have. I've got some woods behind my house, and I've got a couple trees that are dead that I want to take down for firewood. But I can't tell what they are, and I don't really want to waste my time taking something down that isn't going to put out the BTUs that's really worth my while. So there really aren't any branches, small branches on it. I tried to look online a little and look at, like, winter identification of trees. But I can kind of tell what it isn't on a couple things, but is there a good way to know what I'm cutting down?
Well, there is, and it usually involves somebody that knows trees pretty well. They can look at it with you. You could try to take some snapshots with your smartphone, if you have one, and you know, text it to somebody that knows trees or even to one of your extension agents or an arborist. As long as the bark.
Yeah, you need. I was going to say you need trees. The bark, close-up shot of the bark.
Right.
And
okay.
then a long shot of the tree, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And the habit and the form of that tree and the bark will be the best indicator still to be able to identify it.
That'll be good. I just haven't had any luck figuring it out myself. So, I'll go that route.
You know, John, are you on Facebook?
Yep.
Well, what a lot of people do is take that picture, post it on Facebook, and ask all your friends to identify it.
Heck, post it on the Larry Mueller Show. We might be able to identify it just from the photo. Maybe not, but maybe we can.
Yeah, sure.
I will do that. Perfect. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And if we can't, there probably
somebody
else
will. Yeah.
Somebody else will be able to do that. So go to my Facebook page in a little bit. Probably take John a few minutes to get his photos, but hopefully we'll have that before the show's over.
Yeah. You know, I remember this was going on 25 years ago on a graduate botany seminar. We were down in the Smoky Mountains National Park with a professor and a bunch of graduate botany students looking at a 6-foot diameter tulip poplar that the first leaf was had to be at least 100 feet in the air, and none of us, including the professor, could tell what the heck that tree was.
Well, yeah, yeah, it's not a sure thing, but
that's right.
Never know. Patrick in Walworth County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live on the western edge of Walworth County, and I have a tree, an oak tree with oak wilt. It's the only one in my area. I was wondering what to do with that because I'm getting mixed reports from different arborists. Take it down now. It doesn't matter. It's a white oak, a bur oak. And other people are saying wait till winter. My second question is, with emerald ash borer very pervasive in this state, I called the Department of Agriculture at the state, which is the enforcement officers for moving firewood.
Mm-hmm.
And they said you can move firewood from Sauk County to Walworth County because they're both quarantined areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by doing this, aren't we speeding up the spread of emerald ash borer? And I asked him how many tickets they've given out for people moving firewood, and he couldn't answer that. He says, I'm sure there's some, and he's the enforcement officer.
Yeah. A couple of very good questions. With regard to the oak wilt, this is where having an arborist to advise you is actually helpful, and I'm sorry if you've had conflicting advice on that. But while those trees are actively dying, and during their first year after they've died, they will contain active spores that can spread the oak wilt disease, and that's where sanitation is really important. If you do cut those trees, they should be either chipped or burned or piled and covered during that first year to minimize the extent that those spores can be spread by the beetles that spread oak wilt. With regard to whether to cut it now or not, there's also some evidence that if you actually cut a tree that's actively dying with oak wilt, it can increase the root grafting spread of oak wilt to other nearby trees. So the question there really involves how close are other oaks to the tree that's dying and how likely are they to be infected? If there is a risk there, actually girdling that tree and treating it with a herbicide in some cases can be the right thing to do before you cut it down. But you
aren't, aren't white oaks less susceptible of producing fungal mats than red oaks, though? That's what I've been reading.
That's why
of the very, very qualified arborists said, if it was my yard, I'd cut it down now. It's not going to spread. And then another guy's like, no, we don't want to do it. We won't do it. We're going to wait till winter.
Okay. White oaks are less susceptible, but they do become infected. They're not always killed, though. It's not as virulent for a white oak as it is for a black oak or a red oak. If you don't have other white oaks around that are at risk of grafting, that tree is unlikely to graft with black or red oaks. In that case, you might have a safer situation without the risk of spread that would occur if you cut it down.
This is a very large tree, and I heat my home with wood, so if I can cut it down now, I may be able to burn it by the end of the winter. And if I wait till winter, and I leave it sit, is it okay to burn it next year? Or is that fungal mat going to come out of that wood that's been cut?
Well, you may have fungal mats that are in that wood, but the safest thing to do at that point is to pile it on site. Don't move it.
Cover it.
But pile it on site and cover it.
Okay.
That's right.
Yep. There you go.
Your other question about emerald ash borer is an important one, and we're dealing with federal rules that determine the nature of these quarantines. When emerald ash borer is detected in a county, that county becomes subject to quarantine, which means that wood, branch material, any ash products that have bark on it cannot be moved outside the quarantine area. But as you point out, some of these quarantine areas become very large.
Yeah.
And there is a risk that even though you might not be violating the rules of the quarantine, if you move that ash material 50 miles within a quarantine zone, you can absolutely be spreading it.
Absolutely.
And so we need to educate people that if there's ash material that's been infected, or for any reason, if you have ash with the bark on, don't move it. That's the take-home lesson.
That's what I'm concerned about because I see laws all over the place. Don't move firewood more than 50 miles. I'm a hunter. You can see it in the small game regulation manual. And, I know people who move wood up from Illinois, move it from up north.
Yeah.
And, no one's there to enforce it. So.
Yeah.
take-home message, don't move firewood.
Yeah.
Source your firewood as locally as possible. If you can get the bark off that wood, once it's debarked and dried, that's a different situation. But for firewood, keep it at home.
Yep. There you go. Thanks, Patrick. Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois, our next guest. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I am perplexed. We're besieged, actually, by carpenter ants a couple of months ago, and we finally were advised that it was because we'd never had them before, it was because we had cut down a couple of arborvitaes, which were about a foot from the house. And indeed, there were nests down there. And because the wood had been rotting for 2 years, it took 2 years to get to the point of rotting where it attracted the carpenter ants, apparently. So now we've learned that lesson. And we got rid of them. And we have a maple tree that's about 8 feet from the house, that's diseased, old, and hanging over my roof. And we've had it treated, and we've tried, but it has to come down. And my question is, we can have that taken down. We can have the stump removed. But what about all those huge roots that travel across your lawn? Do those have to come out, too, for fear of more carpenter ants?
How
do you remove them?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question for sure, but I've never heard or understood that roots were a habitat for carpenter ants.
No.
Where you usually see those is going to be in the upper stem of that tree where you have a good amount of rot going, right near the ground level and above. I think if you grind that stump,
you're going to be good.
Okay.
Yep.
And Larry is
agreeing with
me on that, which...
I've heard that, yeah. This question has come up in the past on Garden Talk shows, and I know the answers, from Phil, for example, Pelletieri, for example, would have said, I think, exactly what you said.
That's good to know.
So good luck, Anita. Thank you very much for calling. And we have more callers online. Talking trees today with Fred Clark, our guest, founder of Baraboo Woodworks. I want to give... Daryl, in Lanesboro, Minnesota, a chance to join in. Daryl, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning, Daryl.
I've got an old orchard was planted by Leonard Langer. He used to be a professor for the University of Wisconsin, and he's been passed away since late 80s. Uh-huh. But he planted a tree. It's a trees. There's about probably 1,000 to 1,200 left. Mm. And a lot of them are the old standard tree. They're big and, they're too crowded, and I don't want to get involved with spraying those big trees like that. So I'm just wondering if there's any market for applewood or, in large quantities like that.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly an interesting wood. It's hard and has a lot of color and character to it. There's not a well-established commercial market, but that's the sort of material that if you can find somebody in the Lanesboro area to help you with milling that and drying that, and you're willing to do a little legwork to promote the availability of that to local woodworkers and furniture makers, I am sure that you'd have some interest in that product.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good to know. There's quite a few trees. They have a variety of diseases in them, because they just haven't been taken care of for many years, so we're going to pick some this fall. I got a bunch of people just coming in to pick apples. They still bear a lot of them.
Well, and I'll just make another point here. We love wood and we love utilizing trees for wood, but I'll tell you, there's a growing interest in the sort of the cultural value of these old standard apple varieties. And another question I'd be asking, if you have an interest in maybe preserving that area, there are people who have really put a lot of effort into identifying those varieties, because we have many of the, and Larry, you could speak to this, some of the old standard varieties of apples are almost not found anymore.
Yep.
Well, I have thought about it. I've had this place for 20 years probably, and it seems to be, I don't want to cut them down for that particular reason, is because I just won't, as I'm going through, I'm sampling them and seeing if there's something that's really seems to be unique, but I haven't cut them down yet.
Larry, is there an active land trust in the Lanesboro area?
I'm not sure.
You might want to make a call to the Mississippi Valley Conservancy or a group like that, just to see if they have any interest in looking at a resource like that as something that would be worth trying to protect. I'm just trying to think of some options you might want to explore here.
Yeah, be worth a phone call. What the heck?
Yeah.
Those trees have a little history to them, and you know the history, so I'd look into it. Good luck, Daryl. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chuck in Viroqua has a question. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yep.
I got a couple questions. My first question, I've got some white pines that I planted, and they're probably 4 or 5 feet tall, and I noticed that one of them is going completely yellow, and there's one or two others that are look like the needles are starting to get yellow sort of from the inside and moving out. And the only thing I could notice was like a little bit of white something where the branch attaches to the trunk.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's related at all.
Yeah.
Blister rust?
I think. That's what it sounds like. White pine is one of the diseases that white pine is susceptible to is white pine blister rust, which is a fungus, a canker that infects the branches and will ultimately move into the center stem of the tree. And where you have that, you'll see a lot of white oozing and brown wilting of individual branches and finally the whole tree. Now, you know that pines lose their needles every year, too. They just don't lose them all at once.
Yeah.
So you'll always see a little yellowing in the fall. But if you're seeing sort of wholesale yellowing and browning, that sounds like it probably would be blister rust.
And that can spread. Can it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how would I, if I want to keep it from spreading to my other ones, because this one's definitely way yellower than... The rest
right.
of them are green, you know.
Well, the key with that first is good sanitation. So if you have a branch that's infected, but that canker has not moved into the center stem of the tree, you can prune the branch. But any tree that's infected should be pruned or removed, and you want to get that needle material out of there as much as possible. Air circulation is the other cultural practice that'll help minimize the development of blister rust. You need to make sure those trees have good open pruning and they've got airflow and that they're not too crowded.
Okay.
All right.
Can I ask another question? I really enjoy grafting fruit trees, I've just kind of learned on my own, and I'm wondering if there's anywhere in Southwest Wisconsin where you can, like, take a class or work with somebody that's experienced and work with them and...
Boy.
Developing skills.
Boy, Larry, do you know? I don't know the answer.
I'm rubbing my forehead here. There's a wonderful book on grafting, and I cannot remember the name of the author, and I should because it's a classic. Well, maybe it'll come to me, and maybe somebody listening will say, oh, you're thinking of, you know, but there's a classic, a big, thick book on it. But I don't know of any. One thing you might do is you might go to your county extension office or call the county extension office and talk with the horticulture educator there for extension.
Okay.
And if anybody's going to know, it's going to be that person.
And if there's not a class going on, you may be able to encourage them to help organize one.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, for sure. And I will stay listening. I will try. I'm racking my brains right now. I'm trying to remember the name of that book, but it's not coming. Or the author. Chuck, thanks. Carrie from Delafield has several large cherry and hackberry trees that are going to need to come down soon and wants to know some options. What options does she have for seeing these trees get used versus going through a chipper or a landfill?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the niche that the Wisconsin Urban Wood Network is trying to fill. And what we have is, Carrie's situation goes on every day for dozens and dozens of homeowners all around Wisconsin. Our business Baraboo Woodworks is a member of the Wisconsin Urban Wood Partnership, or Wisconsin Urban Wood Network. And that's a consortium of both businesses and organizations around Wisconsin that are dedicated to trying to create the chain that can utilize, you know, cherry and hackberry and valuable trees like carries so they're not wasted. If you go to the Wisconsin Urban Wood website, and I think we've got the website address on the sheet that I brought in, Larry.
Yeah, I think we might have even have it up on my Facebook page. It's Wisconsin Urban Wood Partners. So the address is a long one. It's sustainablewood.org/urbanforest.
Yep. And there's actually a form on that website where someone that has a tree that they want to see utilized can put in information about it that will go out to all the members of the partnership or the network. And if somebody's in a position to be able to use that tree, they can respond and try to create that opportunity.
So again, I'll go back to that. It's sustainable wood. Sustainable at wood. Sustainable at wood. All one word. Sustainable at wood.org. /urban forest and then /professionals. Sustainable at wood. That's the key part.
And you're able to get that on your website or your Facebook page?
Yeah, Michelle can probably put that up on my Facebook page if it's not already up there. I'm pretty sure. I don't think it is yet. So we'll get it up there quickly.
Oh, that's great. So what we'll often do is ask somebody to send us a photo of the tree, and then we can evaluate whether it's something that we can use or that somebody else can use. And really what we have right now is just a collaborative with lots of different users who together, hopefully, we're trying to create a market for this wood. We have folks like Paul Morrison in Verona, who runs a business called The Wood Cycle. It's been doing this for many years. And many other partners who are kind of part of this effort.
You brought along some kind of a cool thing of wood here that I don't know if we've got something up on it that looks sort of like it up on my Facebook page. I think there is. Anyway, explain that for me.
Yeah, well, this is just a sample of some of the wood that we've got in our shop, that most of which has come from urban trees. We've got, and of course, we can't show them on the radio, unfortunately, but we've got bur oak, red oak, white oak, we've got black walnut, we've got hackberry, we've got honey locust. My guess is you've never found honey locust at Menards or Home Depot, but it makes a beautiful, hard, colorful lumber.
Where's that honey locust?
That's honey locust
right
there.
Oh, that is beautiful. Yeah.
We've got black cherry. We've got hickory. We've got, here's a piece of what we call urban ash. This is a green ash that was from a city tree from the city of Madison that we've milled into lumber. And there's beautiful, colorful grain on there. It's also a very hard wood, good wood for flooring. And that's part of the market development right now is we're finding the best uses and outlets for this kind of wood.
Yeah, it's really all these woods, you look at them and they're all really, to me, beautiful in their own way.
And every one of them came within about a 30-mile radius of right where we're sitting.
Ah, that's excellent. Well, I wish, I thought, I was almost positive we had something up, but maybe... If we don't, I'll take a shot of it and put it up on my Facebook page. Keith and Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about my plum tree. And I think it's in its last throes, but I want to see if your expert would agree on this. It looks like there's some fungus growing on the trunk, and then the branches have some fungus, and then the leaves are some of the branches don't even have leaves.
Okay.
And I thought my hard stairs would have finished it off. But every year, every spring, it comes back. The leaves grow on the branches, but I don't know what to do with it. I'm thinking about cutting it down, but I just don't know what to do.
I'll just qualify this by saying that my years as a consulting arborist have been over for about a decade. So I don't take what I say as you want to consult with a consulting arborist. But it sounds like you might have fire blight. Plums are in the family of trees that are susceptible to fire blight. And if you're seeing, you know, fungus can mean a lot of different things, but if you're seeing fruiting body mushrooms on those stems, that is definitely a sign that
fire blight.
Those branches are either dead or it's fire blight. So at some point that can progress to the point where it is just time to take the tree down.
Yeah.
But do you think it can be nursed back to health or not?
Fire blight is tough to control.
This fire blight, I would not even...
Yeah. What I would advise would be to consider removing that tree and replace it with a fire blight resistant variety.
Yeah, and get the tree out. Get it out of there. Get the branches and everything out of there after you cut it down.
Yeah. That's another case where sanitation is important.
Yep, absolutely. Good luck, Keith. Thank you for calling. Talking today with Fred Clark, founder of Baraboo Woodworks. He's a career forester and arborist. Great to have him along as we talk trees on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And on this edition of Garden Talk, we're talking trees with Fred Clark. Join in with your questions and comments. Fred is the founder of Baraboo Woodworks and is very active and involved with the Wisconsin Urban Wood Partnership. We were talking about it earlier, and we had a website, sustainableatwood.org/urbanforest. I'll keep mentioning that, but I think Michelle's going to get it up on our Facebook page in just a few minutes, so you can go take a look at it to learn more about it. In the meantime, post a question on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, maybe a photo. You can post a tree photo or a leaf photo there, or your question as well, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Lynette and Hubertus up next. Lynette, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi, Lynette.
Are you there?
Yes,
hi.
Go ahead.
I have a lilac on a standard, and it produces so many suckers. Is there a way to prevent that, or how do I keep it under control?
Do you have a good pair of hand pruners?
Oh, man, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah. I don't. So you're getting root suckers that are coming up out of the ground?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't have a good answer for you how you would prevent that. I don't know if you do, Larry.
Well, yeah, one of the things, I mean, they're going to just keep coming. One of the things you want to do probably is... I don't know how large the largest ones branches are, but frankly, they will, once they get fairly large, they're going to quit producing lilac, and that's when you want to start pruning those biggest ones, and letting the new ones come to the fore.
Yeah.
So there's a pruning system, usually third.
That's right. And so, yeah, you mentioned it being on a standard. You know, that old cane or that old stem really only has a certain lifespan.
She said on standard, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but at some point you do want to look to having some young shoots, you know, come up and replace that.
Yeah. There's not a lot, otherwise there's just not a whole lot other than a pruning, good pruning shears. Yeah. Joe in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Thanks,
Joe, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Fred, I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
I'm an arborist in training, and with all the ash trees that are coming down over the next few years, I was wondering, you kind of answered my question already, with using ash as flooring.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what the turnaround on using ash, if I was taking all these trees down, what's the turnaround on getting this back as lumber, and what other uses would it be only used for? Cabinetry and flooring? What other uses are there for this ash wood that's coming down? I'll take my answers off there.
Sure.
Right.
So thanks for the call. So, you know, it really, the answer to that question depends so much on scale. In terms of the uses for ash, of course, traditionally, ash has been used, because it's a very good bending wood, it's been used for things like gunnels on canoes, and it's also been used for tool handles.
Baseball bats.
Exactly. It's a good, hard, durable hardwood. But that's also, there's been a limited market for that. What one of the challenges and opportunities, right? That's the Chinese definition of crisis all rolled into one, is looking at the amount of ash wood that's going to be generated in the next 10 years in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest because of Emerald Ash Borer, and trying to scale up markets and uses for that wood, because you know, the city of Madison alone is anticipating taking out over 9,000 trees in the next 5 years. You know, you roll that up statewide, and we're talking about, you know, multiple million board feet of potentially usable lumber. Flooring is one product that seems to have a lot of potential, partly because flooring can be made out of narrow pieces, and it also can be made in random lengths. Which yes. means that if there are defects, they can be removed, and it's a good way to use a kind of a moderate grade of wood. There's certainly cabinet shops and furniture makers who are making beautiful products out of ash right now, and we hope that that will continue. And there's another opportunity that we see out there that could be a very strong one, and that's a process called thermal modification. And the Europeans figured out about a decade ago how to actually treat wood in a special kiln that takes it up to about 400 degrees with steam.
Oh.
And what that does, Larry, it's very interesting, but it cooks the sugars and the starches out of the wood, and it makes it dimensionally stable and rot-resistant.
Ah, oh.
And
great.
So people in the wood industry here are in the region are beginning to look at thermal modification as a potential way to take ash lumber and make it into something that could replace green treated lumber that you might buy at a big box store to build your outdoor deck with. And that would be a tremendous opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
To displace this chemically treated lumber that really nobody likes.
Right.
But we don't have a lot of great options to replace it with.
That is really cool. Claire and Baraboo, I want to give you a chance. Thank you for joining. Hi.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Claire.
Brad, Hi, Brad. This is about one of my neighbor's trees, actually. A sweet old man that died at the age of 94, and his house is still sitting there. The family hasn't sold it yet, but there's this huge oak tree in his front yard. I'd say the diameter is at least 6 feet. I believe he told me one time it was a pin oak. Is there a distinguishing characteristic to tell if that's the kind of oak it is?
Well, there is. Now, there are, pin oak can refer to a couple of different species.
Yeah.
There's a southern pin oak and there's a northern pin oak. I'm guessing that whatever oak that is, it's not quite 6 feet in diameter, but if it's that large, it's probably a southern pin oak, which is a cultivated variety that is occasionally planted here in the Wisconsin landscape. You'll know it's a pin oak. Pin oaks have a very deeply cut, what's called sinus in the leaves and pointed leaf tips. But it has a very characteristic leaf that if you go to any leaf or tree identification guide, you'd be able to see from the leaves.
Yeah, it's very different from the other oaks.
Yep.
Okay. You suspect it's southern, though, not northern, because it wouldn't get that big?
Northern pin oak, number one, is not planted in the landscape environment. It's a tree that grows mostly in northern Wisconsin, and it never gets very big. But okay. it's just not used in the landscape trade.
So go online and find a picture, a photo of the leaf of a pin oak.
Yep.
Southern pin, well, either one or both. And you're going to quickly be able to see how it's different from, for example, a red oak, which also has kind of pointed leaves.
Yeah, that's right. And the form of a southern pin oak is also very different.
Different from a red oak by a lot.
Yeah, it'll be more densely branched and probably have lower branching.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Fred.
Good luck, Claire.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a comment from Bill, a question from Bill from Elm Grove, who wants to know how deep you need to plant a black walnut. You know, start a tree from the black walnut, and should he remove the husk before planting it?
Yeah. Bill, I I hope I'm not the only person you ask this question of. You know, in terms of the removing the husk or not, I don't know that it matters. But for any seed, there's a dormancy scarification requirement that needs to be triggered before that seed will germinate. And I can't tell you off the top of my head what that is for walnut exactly. So you probably want to just do a little reading on that. In terms of the planting depth, though, the traditional rule of thumb is plant it about as deep as the seed is
tall.
Yeah. So, you know, for a walnut, get the thing a couple inches in the ground, and that'll certainly be that'll be fine. But you want to read about stratification requirements for walnut, because you may be able to treat it in a way that'll maximize the germination for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, half the time, you know, we get these walnuts come up because of squirrels.
Right.
They dig them and bury them and bury those walnuts. And, you know, eventually you get cold, you get over winter. And
yeah, exactly.
That kind of gets the seed going. And
yeah, and it's kind of a numbers game. You get enough of them out there and, and they'll come.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, man. Well, Karen had a clump birch that was devastated by Japanese beetles. How do you prevent or retard that devastation each year, and what should she do about it? I mean, I'm thinking there's some hope with Japanese beetles, because usually you'll get a very, very bad year or two with them, and then they start to decline a little bit, and that's kind of what we're seeing across the state of Wisconsin. So that's at least something to think about and consider. Fred Clark is our guest today. Fred is founder of Baraboo Woodworks, a career forester and arborist, conservation leader. Great to have him with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. In most of our yards and gardens, we had a whole variety of plants coming together to create a complete picture. Few would be missed more, though, than our trees. And when your tree goes, that's a big hole in the landscape. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. If, you know, when your tree goes, Fred Clark might be a guy that you'd be working with in some ways, because he's the founder of Baraboo Woodworks. He's a career forester, arborist, been very heavily involved with the Wisconsin Urban Wood Partners, committed to preserving and protecting the urban forest as a sustainable resource. With skill, experience, and craftsmanship, as I actually read a couple of sentences off their charge here. And it's great to have him along to talk about your trees and about how you might use those trees. We've had some great questions, and certainly I see some more here at 1-800-642-1234. Fred, thanks again for being with us today. Really appreciate
it. You bet, Larry. I'm enjoying it.
It's a lot of fun. And Robin in Portage has a question that I know other people have had, I'm pretty sure. So let's go right there. Robin, hi, are you there?
Hi, Larry and Fred. I'm so glad to hear you on, Fred. My question, and if we have time, I have another short kind of comment question.
Okay.
My neighbor just this summer cut down, which I was happy about, some locust trees.
Mm-hmm.
But since that has happened, of course, the roots didn't go.
Right.
And they have been, I've been getting trees all over my yard growing from those roots.
Right.
Well, okay, I've tried to pull up the roots. Well, forget that.
No.
I mean, they're huge
happen.
And they go forever.
Yeah.
So is there a way to... If I just cut the trees off of the root itself, will the root eventually die or what? Or is there no hope?
Well, I wouldn't say there's no hope. You just got to be hopeful for the right things. The locust is a clonal, what's called a clonal species. So that root system of the parent tree can generate lots and lots of suckers that can become one really big root system over time. And that's what's happened here.
Huge,
So do you have the ability to mow those sprouts when they're small?
Well, some of them. I have a lot of them coming up in my prairie garden as well.
Yeah.
No, I can't mow that.
Okay.
I can cut them, but yes, yeah. And I can mow them, the ones that are in the grass area, but otherwise,
yeah. Otherwise,
I have to dig them up.
Well, you're going to need to keep cutting those stems off, but the size of that root system will determine how long they'll continue to keep sprouting.
I see. So eventually the root system will die.
It eventually will.
You're looking at years, though.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Now herbicides, that can be a situation where selective application of herbicide can be effective.
I was going to ask, if I dig up a part of the root and I, cut it in half or whatever, and if I dipped each end into some Roundup or whatever you would use, would that kill the root, or would it also kill everything else that's growing on top of it? Like in, for instance, the wildflower garden.
Yeah, what you're going to want to do there is find a way to systemically or selectively apply that herbicide, ideally to a cut stem.
To a cut stem.
Yeah, so that it can be translocated down into that root system.
But it won't hurt the plants that are growing around it?
Not if you don't touch.
Yeah, that's where it's important to have that application be really selective. And depending on the herbicide that you use, but most of the material that would be available to you would be either Roundup or a 2,4-D type material. I think Roundup would be the one I would probably go with, and it's going to be the safest. You could literally apply that with a paintbrush to those cut stems.
Yeah.
But you're in for a little bit of work, Rob, and there's no doubt about it.
Just a little bit of work, all right.
Yeah.
In addition to this last winter, the person that called in about the walnuts, the black walnut, oh, my Lord, they're growing everywhere, too, because the squirrels obviously couldn't dig down and get their nuts up last year or this spring.
Right. Well.
Okay, do you have time for just one quick comment here?
Sure.
I also have the lady that called in about the oak trees. It's not a pin oak. It's, what was the other, red oak you mentioned? Okay, we've got lots of red oaks here. Mm-hmm. And my neighbor, again, now this is really, I've never seen anything like this before, but I just noticed last summer, I thought, geez, that looks like a weird leaf on that tree. And it is a bur oak that is also now growing out of that tree. Definitely a bur oak, and now there's two branches.
So you're saying that you had a red oak, and now there's a bur oak growing out of it?
Yep. And the tree is healthy and everything. It's just now there's another type of of oak growing out of it.
When you say growing out of it, where does the... Is that at the ground level, or...?
No, at the on a branch.
I don't think you've got it separate.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally you'll see something odd where an acorn might germinate in a little rat pocket down near the ground where you'd have what looks like one tree actually be two species growing together.
No, it's not, definitely not out of the ground, and my neighbor agrees. He says, oh, my God, I can't believe that. Never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, I mean, there is some variety.
Not the same oak.
There's some plasticity in leaf form. Where leaves on one branch, because of various reasons, might look a little different than the rest of the tree, but I have never heard of, there's no immaculate conception when it comes to one species of tree growing out of another. I'd love to see it. Robin,
well,
maybe we can help you.
I can take a picture of it at some point and
I'd love
send
to
it
have
to
you do
you.
That.
Yeah. Send it to you, Larry?
Yeah, put it up on my Facebook page.
Yeah, okay. I don't know how to do that, but I'll figure it out.
Oh, it's not hard.
Yeah, we'd love to.
Okay.
So we might be able to help you with it.
Yeah, no, I would be happy to send it to you.
Please do.
Well, thanks, Robin.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Robin. Appreciate your call. And Scott in Ryle, you are next. Hi, Scott. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. So I've got some big old bur oaks that
around my house, right? It's an old farmstead.
Mm.
And one of them, it's got a trunk diameter of at least 3.5-4 feet.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed last year that the top leaves on this tree, I mean, they all turned yellow and fell off.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it was fine, you know, about a quarter of the way from the peak down.
Mm-hmm.
This year, it came back, and it had leaves pretty much all over it, but now it's been 3/4 of the leaves this year have turned color, and right now it's got about a quarter of the leaves left on it, and I'm starting to notice it on another big bur oak that is right next to it. And I've looked things up, and you know, I've seen either oak wilt or oak decline.
Mm-hmm.
And is there some easy way to tell? I mean, if this is oak wilt, that's bad. And I know that we had a couple of really bad summers and winters and, you know, the drought. And, you know, I'm hoping it's declined because then it might just be one. But, I mean.
Yeah. Well, this is where having a certified arborist come look at those trees is indispensable because you need to get that properly diagnosed if you're going to be able to do anything about it.
Sooner rather than later.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
A couple possibilities there. You mentioned oak wilt, and that's certainly one thing to look for, which can have, you know, that kind of impact on a bur oak, even though, as we discussed earlier, they are less susceptible than the red oaks. Another pest that affects white oak and bur oak is an insect called the two-line chestnut borer. That also frequently causes top dieback or mortality in the upper parts of a tree. So that just based on what you're describing, that's another suspect that I would be looking for out there.
And where would I look for that?
Well, that can be tough to diagnose because you got to get up into the tree to get a sample to find the exit holes and the evidence of that insect isn't easily seen from the ground level sometimes with a big
one. That's why you need an arborist.
That's right.
Okay.
I would get somebody out there pronto.
Yeah. And there are some good arborists in your area there in Columbia County.
Remember, again, a certified arborist.
That's right.
Your best bet.
Yep. Check the County Extension site or check the Wisconsin Arborist Association website for their member list in Columbia County.
Thanks again, Scott, and good luck to you. I want to give Daniel in Green Bay a chance to join us. Daniel, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Like about 2 years ago, I was moving somebody out of a garage, and I noticed growing between the two garages what appeared to be an elm tree. And I know it's been a long time since the Dutch elm disease went through here, and we had to cut down all those beautiful trees. We had one next to our house that was like 125 years old, and we had to cut it down.
Sure.
And I saw that tree growing there. I was sure it was an elm tree. It was dead the next year when I went to look for it.
Yep.
But I've been wondering, could it not be extinct, that species of elm tree?
Oh, yeah.
Not, could I get some seeds for it?
Yeah. So, no, there is no American elm is not extinct at all. Now, Dutch elm disease did wipe out a very big component of our American elm resource in the 1960s and 70s. But American elm, fortunately, is alive and well. I shouldn't say well. They are often infected still by Dutch elm disease, but you can find American elms growing throughout the area.
You go to if you are ever in Canada in Saskatchewan, go to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. The entire city is covered with American elm trees, and the
they're very beautiful trees.
Oh, it's like. It reminds me of Madison, Wisconsin, you know, all those years back before the elm bark beetle came in and took out our elms.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no shortage of elm seeds around, and it's not, you know, there's nothing rare about it. It's not to say you couldn't collect those seeds, but, you know, the real trick now is breeding American elm varieties that are going to be resistant to Dutch elm disease, and there is work going on to do that.
And there are some that are pretty good.
That's right.
One developed right here at the University of Wisconsin. So,
Oh, I did not know that.
Yep.
So do you know off the top of your head where I could send away for some seeds like that?
You know, if you got a good Green Bay area, you're going to have some businesses that sell trees and shrubs and so forth, and I think any number of those good reputable ones. I'm not really talking big box here. I'm talking more here.
Right, your sort of traditional nurseries.
Nurseries, yeah.
I think Liberty Elm, Liberty Elm is one of the varieties of elm that's
Liberty Elm
that's been bred for disease resistance, and you should look for that name.
Okay, Liberty Elm. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And there's another one or two out there yet too that you could consider, and I think one of your nurseries is going to be able to help you out.
Yep.
Jane and Cornucopia. Hello to you.
Hi, I'm great, but I'm calling about erosion problems and wondering if there's any type of tree or smaller tree that you could plant on the bank that would help prevent erosion, so it would have a root system that was more extensive and maybe would hold the ground a little bit. And the second part of my question is very different, but I'm wondering in the company that you have, if they have any type of turning blocks or turning wood. My husband is a wood turner and always looking for a new resource.
Yeah.
And I can take my answer off the air.
All right.
Sure, Jane. Two good questions, different topics. On the erosion, depending on what you're looking at there, you need somebody to help evaluate that site and figure out what kind of vegetation will best help minimize erosion. And the one thing that I would say, just as a general comment, is you probably want to look at herbaceous vegetation, perhaps more so than trees. A good native grass or a vegetation with a grass component often will put on a much more dense fibrous root mass that can do a better job in some cases of holding that slope than trees would. This is where you need to have a landscape designer or landscaper help evaluate that site.
Yeah, you got a really good extension agent up there in your county that you might just get a call to the extension office, because you'll get a good listing from them of shrubs that will work well under those circumstances for the Bayfield area.
Yeah. You also asked about turning blocks, and we are beginning to just now to start producing some of those for sale to the craft market and woodworkers and hobbyists. And so stay tuned and check our website from time to time, and as we have that available, we'll put notice of it out there.
Gene in Almond, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi,
I have a question about glossy buckthorn and common buckthorn.
Sure.
I'm controlling it on my land, but I've recently found a couple pieces or a couple trees that are shrubs that are pretty big. One is about 6 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any problem with using the wood?
No.
I guess, do you know of any reactions with skin or anything like that?
No, not with buckthorn. It's the outer part of the buckthorn that'll have a reaction to your skin when that thorn tears into it. But in terms of using the wood, and the common buckthorn especially, can grow to a pretty big size. One of my longtime colleagues, Jim Berkemeyer, out in Spring Green, has turned buckthorn into pens for many years that he sells through his shop at Timber Green Forestry. So very usable, nice. It's got a nice orange cast to that wood that is very attractive and distinctive.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Harry in Soldiers Grove, hi to you.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I planted currants, both red and black, some years ago, and also white pines.
Yep.
Noticing that there are also a lot of gooseberries in the woods. Don't have a problem yet with the rust, but since they're co-hosts for each other, I wonder how likely is it that I'm going to have a problem with rust developing, and is there anything I should do to prevent it?
Well, that is a really important question. You know, back in the 1930s, and we'll just back up here on the biology of white pine blister rust, the rust diseases all require an alternate host. And so in this case, white pine blister rust, the disease completes its life cycle by having part of it occur on gooseberries,
yeah.
Members of the Ribes family or genus, and part of it on pines. And it needs both species in order to complete that cycle. You know, in the 30s and the CCC days, there were crews that scoured the countryside to get rid of the gooseberry in order to prevent blister rust on our white pines. I think today the thinking among the plant pathologists is that really it's hard to be effective doing that.
Yeah.
And you'll never get every last gooseberry anyway, and the stuff can travel so far that I've never understood, or my understanding right now, I should say, of the science of it is that it's usually not worth trying to eliminate gooseberry. You want to keep your pines vigorous. You want to grow them on a good site. You want to prune them so there's good air circulation. And you want to practice good sanitation so that if you are seeing any disease incidents, you can prune or remove those trees right away.
Sure. Okay. So by planting the currants, I inadvertently completed the cycle.
Well, possibly, but it's hard to know what extent there would be native currants around there anyway that would also be doing that same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So basically, I'm okay leaving my currants there. I was thinking about taking them out. But as long as I don't have a problem yet, just kind of wait and see.
Well, do you have a white pine plantation, or what are you?
No. This is just a few dozen trees.
And how big are they?
And they're about 7 years old.
Okay.
All right.
I would just pay close attention to those trees and be ready to prune proactively if you see any evidence of it.
I'd be tempted. If you don't really care that much about those berries, I'd just get rid of them.
That's what I'd do anyway.
Because you just, you know, it's tempting. You're sort of risking. You're a little bit of a risk there.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Fred, boy, we've covered a lot of things here today. And I want to go back to Baraboo Woodworks.
Yeah.
A bit. You know, tell us, you know, again here in this last minute or so about Baraboo Woodworks.
Sure. Well, we started this business really with the idea in mind to try to create better connections between people who are investing in trees and managing trees and end users. And in a career as a forester, you know, despite people's best efforts, you know, the options for utilizing your wood are sometimes very limited. So what we do is we work with a small number of family forest owners who have long-term management goals, and we use some of their wood in our business. And then the other component of it is urban trees. We have a contract this year with the city of Madison to actually provide sawmill services for the city. And what we're doing there is mainly trying to find the best markets and utilization for the ash that's we're just beginning to see start to be removed around the city. This is a business model that all of us are kind of inventing here as we go.
It's a wonderful, wonderful idea and a great business, I think.
Well, the one thing we know is there's more of this wood coming. So
you're not going to run out of you're not going to run out of wood, Fred. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and we've got a link to your site on my Facebook page, Baraboo Woodworks. If you just go and Google that in Baraboo Woodworks, you're going to find it. Fred Clark, thank you so much for being with us today.
You too, Larry. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, yeah. Fred, founder of Baraboo Woodworks, career forester. It was great to have him on the show today. And thanks to him, and thanks to you for listening. And, oh, my goodness, we had these insect questions. I forgot that Phil Pelletieri is going to be with us Monday at 11 o'clock. So he'll be answering more insect questions for sure. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.